that's Segundo here, and I'm feeling a bit sad, for this is show number 69, and I fear that I will have to pay good money for a certain bedroom technique which celebrates this fantastic number. I'd say it's quite an achievement, but I've called every escort service in my local alt weekly, and the lowest bid was $500. $500? This is ridiculous. Well, I was urged by certain parties to try out a comparative website called Priceline. I managed to beat the $500 mark, I'll have you know, but instead of locating an affordable escort service, I got a $299 round trip to Wichita, Kansas. Perhaps this is part of the problem of living in a capitalist society. I wouldn't know. I don't pay attention to these tax things, much less these credit card things. I let my accountant handle this. But this week's guest, Annalie Newitz, had a few words to say about this particular social predicament.
So I am here with Annalie Newitz, author of Pretend We're Dead, Capitalist Monsters in American Pop Culture. Annalie, how are you doing?
I'm good.
First off, I wanted to sort of establish what a capitalist monster is. You kind of established this a little bit in the introduction where you note that it's a person or entity who cannot tell the difference between commodities and people, who confuse living beings with inanimate objects, and someone who feels dead because they spend far too much time working, which certainly applies to a lot of people. But
Yeah. This
is quite a broad category, and I wanted to see if we could maybe, you know, pinpoint exactly what it is. I mean, not only that, but, you know, I get confused all the time myself between, you know, inanimate objects and living beings. I had a book drop, you know, last night. I didn't know if it was a living being. I mean, what? let's clarify. What is a capitalist monster exactly?
Well, in this book, I'm looking specifically at stories about monsters. And so what I wanted to do was talk a little bit about a particular kind of story that takes place at a certain time in American history when capitalism has become kind of our national religion. And so the monsters that I'm looking at are different from your typical sort of gothic monster that we're all familiar with from like Dracula. And I think it wouldn't be difficult for me to convince you that Dracula is a sexual monster. And many people have written about this, and it's almost a kind of a cliche to say, you know, well, look, he's sucking on people. He has these teeth that penetrate the bodies of beautiful women, and there's always heaving bosoms like everywhere you look in Dracula. And so what I wanted to do is say, well, actually, there's also a place for monsters whose terror and whose monstrosity essentially comes from fears about capitalism.
Sure.
And so, as you pointed out, I talk a little bit about what the characteristics of these monsters are. I think one of the classic monsters who is a capitalist monster is Jekyll from Jekyll and Hyde. And we could talk more about that a little bit if you want. But essentially, Jekyll is struggling with his professional identity. In almost every retelling of the story, any version of it that you watch, going back to the really early 1921 version with John Barrymore, or even the really contemporary versions like Mary Riley, which had actually a moment where Julia Roberts was kind of groovy. They're all about a man struggling with his professional identity and how to be a doctor and how to be an upstanding citizen while at the same time giving into all kinds of desires and feelings that are considered inappropriate for a good businessman and a good upstanding professional in the community. And so he solves it, you know, by experimenting on himself and turning himself into this monster. And so his struggle with his professional identity and with his job turns into a struggle with monstrosity. So that's why I say he's kind of a classic capitalist monster. And then we see all kinds of other ones that I talk about in my book.
But Jekyll and Hyde is also very much a psychoanalytical monster, even though Robert Louis Stevenson's work actually preceded Freud.
Sort of. Actually, he was writing sort of during Freud's early career.
Yeah.
He is. And I think that, I mean, one of the things I deal with in this book is how capitalism as, you know, as a social force creates a lot of psychological trauma and creates a lot of psychological monstrosity. And I have a whole section of the book about what I call mental monstrosity. And you see this happening particularly in stories about people who are struggling with jobs that are professional, jobs where they have to produce ideas instead of, you know, the classic sort of, you know, on an assembly line type job where you're doing backbreaking labor and producing objects. like cars or, you know, widgets. So somebody like Jekyll, his consciousness has been really invaded by the desire to be productive, a productive citizen, a productive professional doctor. And the further you go along in the 20th century, because I sort of trace these films and these monsters throughout the 20th century, the more and more you see movies that are preoccupied with what it means to have your psychology shaped by your job. And that's why, for example, I'm really obsessed with brain movies. And I talk a lot about movies like Donovan's Brain. And Donovan is also a doctor, because these are people who are struggling with, you know, again, how do you continue to feel like you are yourself when you spend so much of your day doing mental labor for other people? And again, I mean, this is Jekyll's problem all the time. He never knows when to stop working. In a lot of the movies, he spends his off hours doing charity work as a doctor. He's just constantly, his mind is constantly immersed in his work, and much to the chagrin of his fiance, although not in the book, because the book doesn't have a fiance. They only invented that for the movies.
They needed a love interest, you know.
Yeah, they needed to reassure us that it wasn't a book about, it wasn't a story about homosexuality, which I think pretty much everyone agrees that the Stevenson story is. So that's kind of the long answer to how sort of psychology gets involved, because in, you know, when you have to labor in order to live, and when you have to do mental labor in order to live, really your mind is what's at stake in sort of in these movies and in these stories. It's always about who owns your mind, and there's several movies that are really interesting on that point. So,
well, you also pursue ideological metaphors in some interesting ways, like you reference Birth of a Nation and point out that the Klan army in that is actually an army of the undead. Aren't you sort of granting yourself a little too much latitude here?
Well, as a critic, I can give myself as much latitude as I want. Yeah, and actually, I really, that in that section, I'm talking specifically about how racial issues come into the capitalist monster story. And particularly, I talk about colonial and post-colonial relationships, because colonialism, of course, aside from being like the nifty thing that founded America, is also an economic system, which is usually founded on either enslaving a particular class of people, in this case, African Americans, or it might just mean, you know, practically enslaving a group of people, like as when the Brits went to India. Mm-hmm. So what I'm looking at in when I talk about Birth of a Nation, I'm talking about what's happening in 1915 in U.S. culture to the ways in which white people who are coming out of a colonial system where blacks worked for free because they were slaves, how they're reimagining their relationship with blacks. Now, the traditional analysis of the film, which I think is correct, is that obviously it's a racist film. It's about white domination. It's a fantasy. It's a white fantasy about being able to, you know, take over the economy again and have a strong presence again, despite the fact that blacks are now, you know, have the vote and are now, you know, technically empowered, if not practically in real life empowered. So what I wanted to do, though, was say, well, look, there's another story going on here. What happens when a dominant group can only imagine having power by putting on white sheets and acting like ghosts? There's actually a scene in the film where we see the founder of the KKK coming up with the idea for the white outfits by watching little kids dress up as ghosts. So we know in the film explicitly that this is about dressing as ghosts to be scary.
I remember, I'm a film major, so when the title card of The Inspiration came up, it was just hilarious. Everybody laughed.
Yeah, and it's such a creepy scene. I mean, there's so much about that film that's kind of bizarre and creepy. But so what I wanted to ask was, you know, what does that mean that this group is imagining themselves as dead? And yet this is supposed to be an empowering story, because, of course, being dead is a pretty disempowering position, you know, really, if you think about it. And so I said, you know, just as every narrative kind of has within it, you know, certain kinds of, particularly narratives like Birth of a Nation, which are about whites feeling the need to reassert power, in other words, feeling as if they've had some kind of power shortage and wanting to reassert it, I think there's a lot of fear and anxiety in that narrative on the part of the whites who made it and on the part of the whites who were watching it and sort of taking pleasure in it. And so I talk about that side of the story. You know, what is the fear that drives a white filmmaker and a white audience to want to depict themselves as ghosts, to want to tell this kind of story? And yes, it's a story about white triumph, but it's only a story about white triumph in death, and that the whites take on the guise of death. And I think that in many ways, that especially if you look at this film in the context of the history of race relations in this country, in some ways it is a story about the death of white power, because even though white racism and white supremacy continue throughout the 20th century, they never again will reach the pinnacle of white power during slavery. Blacks are no longer enslaved, and that's not going to happen again. And certainly, blacks have not achieved perfect parity with whites, but I do think that this is a film that's about the fear that, in fact, white power is dead. And as films about the undead throughout the 20th century demonstrate, and I talk about this in the book, you see more and more stories about that kind of whiteness, a kind of whiteness which is ghostly, a white power which is trying to return from the dead, or conversely, white people who are haunted by black ghosts who basically kill them and destroy them. And so it's very interesting to see how that image of death can be both one where the dead person is trying to reclaim power, but is also sort of admitting to the fact that their power is gone. So,
but is it so much a capitalist monster symbol, or something that involves more of like, well, these films have a sort of underlying streak of capitalism? And not only that, but also, is it inherently tied into capitalism? Is it not necessarily just a reflection of American society? I mean, that yes, capitalism is part of it, but it's not, you know, the linchpin, so to speak.
I think in some films, it is the linchpin. I think in other films, it's not. The movies that I've looked at in this book, a lot of them like any kind of narrative, literary narrative or film narrative, they're open to a lot of different interpretations. And what I wanted to highlight by looking at these films was the fact that there is a lot of terror about economic relations that drives these narratives and that drives us to consume the narratives. And I think there's a case to be made that that is a huge part of, you know, our fears in American culture, that the fear of, for example, having to work a crappy job, the fear of lower class people coming into your neighborhood and taking over your house or killing you for your money, which is kind of a way of talking about class warfare. There's fears about, disenfranchised groups, you know, getting revenge on, wealthier people. These are all fears that are played out in story after story, and they're part of the fears that are engendered by living in a capitalist culture where some people get to make a lot of money while some people make far less. Or you could say, looked at another way, a culture where you have to work at doing things you don't like in order to survive.
Well, going back to this issue of slavery, which we're talking about both in the form of Birth of a Nation as well as this
wage
particular
slavery.
Issue. Yeah, exactly. Wage slavery. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Mark Ames's book, Going Postal, but he actually offered a very interesting argument where the people who commit office massacres are actually basically revolutionaries in some sense, because they are actually responding to this kind of oppressive system, which, by the way, shares some of the language and the characteristics of slavery. And he actually offers a very interesting sort of argument. You offer something sort of similar in your serial killers chapter, where you note that Jeffrey Dahmer was unable to distinguish between the labor of murder as well as the labor of actually, you know, working in a chocolate factory. But Jeffrey and the Chocolate Factory.
I know.
Wouldn't that be a great movie?
That will never be made.
I know. But I want to actually point out that if we look at the history of serial killers, if we look at like Sonny Bean became a crazed cannibal because he decided to sort of, you know, flee the kind of life. He was just a lazy guy. So I'm wondering how do we actually account for individual impulses here? Like Sonny Bean just being lazy, or someone being sort of, having underlying violent tendencies. How can you commingle the capitalism with the individual impulses?
I think that's a really good question. And actually, you may be disappointed in my answer, which is that you can't. I mean, this is not a book about looking at individual psychology and trying to say, you know, here is a person, a real person who was driven mad by capitalism. I'm sure that there are examples of people who have been driven mad by the lust for money or by office politics. But this is really a book about how we as a culture interpret stories about violent murder, and in that chapter about serial killers. And so I'm very interested in books about serial killers, movies about serial killers, and the sort of popularity of the stories of certain killers, like Jeffrey Dahmer, who is such a popular murderer. You know, everybody was very excited about him for all kinds of reasons. He just made an interesting, almost fictional character, because once his story was turned into movies and books, people really consume it as a kind of story. And the way that his story has been written is very telling. And so what I'm interested in is not so much whether one could say it's true that Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, actually was suffering from a classic Marxist problem in capitalism, which is that, you know, you can't tell the difference between real people and commodities because everything's been reduced to money. So if we can trade everything for money, you could be equivalent to a car. Like, I don't know how much money you make a year, but maybe I could trade your salary for a year for like a couple of cars. And so, you know, Ed equals 6 cars or something like that.
Well, that would be nice if I made that kind of
I know, that'd be groovy. Well, maybe crappy cars. I don't know. But so, or bikes or something like that.
I
know. How many bikes
do you... Pogo stick for you.
All right. Yeah, no, actually, you'd trade me in for a really awesome pogo stick. I'm probably worth like a Segway or something like that. So, you know, so that's the sort of classic problem in a Marxist view of capitalism. And, you know, so did Jeffrey Dahmer suffer from that? I mean, we'll never know. He's dead now. You know, he probably wouldn't have been very coherent on this point anyway. But what we can say is that the stories that have been told about his murders, for example, we know that he worked in a chocolate factory at the time that he was apprehended, where he stirred giant vats of chocolate in big barrels. And we also know, as many newspaper accounts lovingly told us, that the way he disposed of the bodies of his victims was he had a giant vat of acid in his apartment, and he would dump their bodies in and stir it up. And then he would often keep parts of their bodies in his freezer and eat them, which is it clearly seems to mirror what he was doing at work. And so his work time and his work activities kind of spilled over into his, you know, leisure time, where he was murdering people and eating them and stirring them as if they were chocolate.
But maybe he was just concentrating on skills that he happened to be good at. Okay, look, this works really well in the chocolate factory. I'm employable because of these skills. Let's see, how do I dispose of the bodies? Well, hey, why don't I actually construct a vat? And then, therefore, there's not too much of a crossover. Maybe he was just a lazy guy, you know? I mean, well, it's not easy to, like, dispose of bodies, you know?
It's not easy to dispose of bodies.
Not that I have
bodies.
Any personal experience, but, yeah. You know.
It's true. And he learned well from his job. And I think, like I said, I think what's interesting is that it's true. It could be, you know, again, with almost any narrative, you can say, well, maybe a cigar is just a cigar. You know, like, these movies are just fun and these stories are just fun and we're just consuming them because we're being entertained. And I would never argue with that. He probably was. I mean, he was nuts. He was a lazy guy. It's fun to read about him. All those things are true. But then the question becomes, you know, why do these stories have such enduring fascination for us? And why is it that, for example, those details leap out at us? You know, and it's the same thing with, you know, other serial killers that I talk about in that chapter. For example, the Unabomber, who arguably was a serial killer since he did kill people in serial, although there was this whole move to claim that he was a terrorist. I don't think so. I think he was just another serial killer. And I think his story was treated that way. I think that part of what drives our interest in that is that we do see the way these people were utterly transformed mentally by the kind of work that they did, to the point where when they killed someone, which is this incredibly aberrant, violent, horrifying thing, they did it using the tools and the mechanisms of labor that they'd been doing all their lives. For example, the Unabomber was a mathematician and a philosophically minded academic, and he killed, I mean, my favorite thing about him was that he literalized the academic injunction to publish or perish. He said, if you don't publish my essay, you know, people will perish. And again, you know, you could say, well, nutty guy, blah, blah, blah. But I think that at the same time, he was both of these guys, you know, the Unabomber and
Dahmer.
Dahmer. Yeah, please edit that out.
Ted and Jeffy.
It's like, and as my brain is invaded by capitalism, I'm unable to remember anything.
Brains. Yeah.
As Dahmer, you know, demonstrate, that, like I said, they're both, it just seems sort of this tragic moment where they turn the logic of their work into the logic of murder. And so we see this connection being developed in these stories where, you know, serialized production, mass production can turn into serialized mass production of dead bodies.
But okay, well then look at another serial killer while we're on the subject. Charles Whitman, you know, what's his backstory history? Pretty normal guy. He just goes to the top of the University of Texas and just starts pecking people off. I mean,
among serial killer scholars, there's a distinction made between serial killing and then a mass murderer, like Whitman.
Fair enough.
So, you know, I know it's very silly to make that distinction, and I actually think you could argue that Whitman had other issues, but
he just was a serial killer who just wanted to do it all at once.
Right. And I mean, there was that whole trend for a while of the kind of McDonald's killers, was the school shooters as well, which I think is a whole other issue. But that's, again, a mass murder. And so the reason why serial killing is interesting to me is because it takes place in the same way that the mode of mass production does under capitalism, where you're repeatedly producing the same object. And oftentimes serial killers do try to produce the same kind of dead body again and again, like they'll kill in the same way or they'll always want to position the body in a certain way. And so that's really interesting. And the guy who invented the term serial killing named it after the movie serials. So he specifically had in mind kind of a mode of cultural production when he was naming them, and a mode of storytelling too, which is kind of interesting.
But going back to the whole Saudi Bean thing, I mean, you know, Saudi Bean wasn't employed at all. He just decided to start, you know, cooking people in the cave, you know? I mean, you know, it's not entirely, I guess, you know... maybe I'm quibbling here over attaching the whole, you know, capitalism label to serial killers, but, you know, I guess I'm trying to sort of again understand how, I mean, you know, maybe I guess we'll just have to accept that, you know, there are individual impulses, and there is also this capitalistic sort of approach, the paradigm of looking at it.
And I think, again, like what I would want to emphasize is that my analysis about capitalist monsters is not foolproof, right? You can't apply it to every story, just like you can't claim every story is really about sex, or every story is really about gender.
It's not like the long tail of the tipping point. This is the first I've ever heard from any nonfiction writer. Well, wow.
I'm sorry, but it doesn't work all the time because there's other social horrors and other social concerns that drive us as well. So I would never claim that I have like a blanket solution to every narrative, as much as it would be nice to believe that that were true. So I think that you're always going to get, you know, examples of people who are driven mad and whose stories are told to elicit fears about other kinds of things. That's how fear works. You know, sometimes we're afraid of having to work a shitty job. Sometimes we're afraid of having sex with our dad, you know? So different fears, you know, there's psychosexual terror and there's economic horror. And sometimes they appear in the same narratives, but sometimes they don't.
Okay, gotcha. Well, actually, going back to this issue of nomenclature, tying this into your book and tying this into the last strand of conversation that we just wrote and wove. And I've had a double Americana before.
I need more coffee right now.
More coffee.
This is the sound of me drinking coffee.
But no, the differential between...
differential.
You're just making me giddy. I don't know what it is. Between serial killer and terrorists. Mm-hmm. You know, how does nomenclature sort of tie into the way that people kind of, tie into these, concoct these cultural narratives? Is nomenclature a major factor in terms of, you know, fashioning, whether intentionally or unintentionally, these sort of capitalistic underpinnings? Or?
I think, Yes. One of the things that I was really interested in was how after the 9/11 terrorist incident in New York and Washington, the way that a lot of the stories that we used to tell about serial killers kind of got quickly grafted on to stories about alleged terrorists. And one of the really interesting moments was when, I don't know if you remember, but there was the sniper killers, they were in Baltimore and DC, kind of in and around the Beltway area. And it was just two guys, had no real political identity. One of them was Jamaican and one of them might have been Muslim or had family members that were Muslim. Basically, it was two guys who were drifters, unemployed, who had created this incredibly elaborate sniper setup in the trunk of their car, mm-hmm. and would go around and just shoot people out of the trunk of the car, and you know, hide in the trunk and then shoot people. And it was very terrifying because it felt very random, and because they were using guns and doing it from a distance and had a kind of pseudo military MO, and I say pseudo with like extreme emphasis, like imagine italics and like boldface on the pseudo, because they really weren't terrorists, and yet the media portrayed them as terrorists. They were pursued and charged under laws that were applicable to terrorists, mm-hmm. and their whole story was recast, I think completely erroneously, as a story about some kind of political malcontents who were getting back at the, you know, good American people. Mm-hmm. And it was tremendously interesting to me because 5 years ago, they would have absolutely just been portrayed as serial killers and they would have been represented as psychos.
Just like the California snipers, remember them? They were like actually pecking off people. This was like a couple years before 2001, but they were pecking people off of I-5.
Uh-huh.
They were up
oh, yeah, I do remember that. This? Yeah.
They were like, because they were basically between Sacramento and Reno.
Yeah.
But they were basically like pecking people off in the mountains.
Yeah.
Were they terrorists, you know?
Yeah, and I think now they would be portrayed as terrorists. Yeah. And so it's very interesting to me because I think a lot of the ways in which we, so I think that what's happened is there's been this grafting of the terrorist story onto the serial killer story. And what I find extremely disturbing about that in terms of political rhetoric is that serial killers, their motives may be, you know, pushed ahead by unconscious trauma around, say, work or sex or whatever it is that's driving them. But we know for sure that the reason why they're doing what they're doing is because they're just simply insane. Mm-hmm. The reason why terrorists do what they do is not because they're insane, but because they have a political motivation. Now, we may disagree with the motivation. We may disagree that it's correct to kill people for political reasons. I personally disagree with that idea. However, their motivations are not the motivations of an insane person. They're just simply the motivations of political extremists. And so I think that it suits the Bush administration quite well to blur the two stories, the story of the random psycho driven mad by something in his life and the terrorist, and kind of confuse those stories, because then it turns terrorism into madness. It turns it into something that we can't ever understand, that something that's completely apolitical, mm-hmm. that it's just the work of madmen. So when we call serial killers terrorists, like the Unabomber or these snipers, we really drain a political act of all its political meaning. And again, like I said, it's fine, you know, politically to say, you know, here's these terrorists, they're doing something for a political reason, we totally disagree. But that's a very different thing from saying these people are just insane. Terrorism equals serial killing. There's no way to understand it. There's no way to deal with it in a political context at all. All we can do is kill them or apprehend them and send them to jail. And so I think that that's, you know, very characteristic of our current political situation and our current way of analyzing what's happening when people engage in serial killing. It's a very interesting transformation in the narrative, I think.
During the course of your research, did you observe any sort of ways in which, like, films or books had kind of, you know, that something like this, the blurring between what is a serial killer and what is a terrorist, transform kind of the definitions of literature or film? I mean, you know, that's kind of was the initial sort of thrust of the question here, mm-hmm. but I guess, you know, did you see this through the many types of people who you were identifying? And maybe, you know, asking this question, maybe, mm-hmm. I know that this came out of doctoral research. What steps did you take to kind of get this into sort of the readable form? I was actually surprised. I was like, wow, there's a lot of notes, but it's quite readable. So two-prong question here.
Two-prong question. Yeah. So I think your first question was you were sort of asking, let me make sure I understand, but you were sort of saying, did I see a transformation in literature?
Or did you see, around, like, in terms of terminology that is introduced,
yeah,
like, you know, serial killer becomes terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see anything like that in any of the, you know, because there wasn't anything specific that you cited in your book, but mm-hmm. if you did observe something like this, can you think of like a sort of a cultural film that sort of, you know, responded or was influenced by this? We were mentioning like the Dr. Jekyll films before, how they mm-hmm. added the whole, you know, love interest thing to sort of quell the gay impulse and the mm-hmm. and I mean, you know,
yeah.
and you know, maybe, you know, was there something else that maybe ties into either shifting terminology mm-hmm. or nomenclature? And or to hell with that question.
I think, I mean, I would go back a little bit, like, to looking at the sort of shift from serial killer to terrorist, or the kind of blurring of those two categories. I mean, I do think that looking at the way the sniper story was portrayed in media, which, I mean, there's always a fictionalization process when
sure.
things are, you know, talked about in news media. I do think that that's a really excellent example of how something that would once have been considered serial killing became terrorism. And I think a movie, for example, like Fight Club, which comes, you know, kind of around that time, although is clearly not a post 9/11 film, still kind of dealt with that blurring as well. And that you saw after Fight Club. I mean, Fight Club is about a terrorist cell, but they're specifically protesting nothing, really. I mean, they're protesting consumer culture. I mean, it's actually quite an interesting kind of narrative about, you know, capitalism and murder, because these are guys who are upset by their yuppie lifestyles and kind yeah. of want to engage in killing as a relief from...
They're protesting sort of this kind of self-entitlement that, you know, this impulse hasn't gone away. Certainly, like, this mm-hmm. this nature of, like, oh, I'm entitled to be a rock star, or I'm entitled to, you know, have the American dream, so to speak, when
right.
in fact, no, you're not entitled to anything. You have to earn that, you know, and there's no guarantee that you'll earn that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's no guarantee of upward mobility. It's like sort of the expectation of upward mobility that is at the thrust of the, you know, the revolutionary point of these terrorists.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's, yeah, no, I do think that that's right. That part of what they're protesting is that sense of entitlement, and that, but again, they're also protesting the symbols of that entitlement. And so part of what they target are the things, the objects which symbolize wealth. So the things of consumer culture that we all believe that we're entitled to, even if we don't all get to have them.
Yeah.
And so I think, like I said, I think that was a really interesting moment in terms of film, because it's such an influential film and really did create this kind of new way for filmmakers to imagine, and for writers to imagine, a kind of deadly prankster figure who's protesting consumer culture. And so that, I mean, that was an interesting shift for me, like, in terms of how film was dealing with terrorism, because it became something that was, like I said, the fact that it was pranksterish and that it was done for fun goes back to this notion of serial killing, because serial killers are also called recreational killers. They're doing it kind of in their spare time as a hobby. You know, it's a fun thing. It's a break from work, although it often looks like work. I don't want to make light of death and murder here, but I'm just talking about how the narratives sort of portray murder.
Because death and murder is a really serious thing.
Yes,
it has absolutely no comic value whatsoever.
No, I mean, you know, I have to be careful, because sometimes when I talk about this stuff, you know, I get a little goofy about it and people get really offended, you know, like, what are you saying, that serial killing is this amusing thing that people do for fun in their spare time? And, you know, I don't, you know, think that it's okay to kill people in your spare time. I just want to get that out there and then move on. At any rate, I think that was an interesting turning point. So hopefully that answers your question about whether there's been any kind of shift in how literary narratives are dealing with serial killing or dealing with terrorism. I do think that they've been kind of merged in public consciousness.
But it's also the thing about their revolt, and I will get back to your book.
Yeah,
I promise.
No, I'm trying to think of other more contemporary narratives that come after Fight Club, where you see kind of terrorists who are also just crazy. I mean, I think that that's a really interesting...
You could make a case for, oddly enough, I would put, like, Hackers or Sneakers. Mm-hmm. You know, those two movies came right before September 11th, and there was a sort of revolutionary thrust, particularly with, like, yes, we've got the, you know, in Sneakers, yes, we've got the old dogs from the hippie, you know, the 60s, who are, like, you know, like these sort of father avuncular kind of figures for, like, the young band of new hackers or something like that. I don't, that might qualify.
Yeah. But I think, again, I mean, what's nice about something like Sneakers or Hackers, I mean, yes, they are considered crazy, but... you at least get the sense that these revolutionaries or these potential killers have a political agenda.
Yeah.
Whereas what I'm interested in is kind of this moment where the political agenda of the terrorist disintegrates. And the only thing we see is someone who's just a madman or a madwoman. And so that the serial killer figure and the terrorist figure are totally combined. And so there's no sense of the terrorists having any kind of politics at all or any kind of rationality, even
they're
if it's
monsters,
twisted.
Yeah,
they become monsters. And I think, you know, certainly you could say that for example, the bad guy in Sneakers is a kind of political monster.
Yeah.
But at least he has politics. And we kind of sympathize with his politics a little bit, you know? I kind of understand what he's getting at, you know? But I think as we kind of continue into this, you know, war on terrorism, you're seeing more and more narratives where the terrorist just doesn't seem to have any motivation other than just wanting to kill.
You know, one we haven't even mentioned is V for Vendetta. That was this year. That's absolutely timely, you know?
That is really timely. And actually, it was interesting that, I mean, that story really, I think, could only have been made now as, you know, science fiction and also set in England, because that way it's safely, you know, not in America.
Hilariously,
not happening now.
Yeah, after the London thing, you know.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Totally.
But that's actually an interesting one too, because there you don't really get the sense that he's a brainless killer at all. I mean, you really get the sense that he does have a real reason for his revolutionary activities. So, which is different from in the comic book, where he actually is quite a bit of a psychopath, you know, and he does a lot of things for no reason.
He's a more sympathetic figure, definitely, in the movie.
In the film, I think, I mean, and that was one of the things that kind of made me sad about the film, was I was like, you know, he's supposed to be... psychotic.
Well, like, for God's
he's
sake,
supposed to be torturing
I know the
her.
Torture sequence, I mean, it worked in the movie, but it didn't have nearly the sort of, like, Jesus Christ, this guy's really hardcore, there's something off about him, you know. And instead, you know, we get images in the movie of him kind of just laughing maniacally or something and just going for this whole Phantom of the Opera approach, but that wasn't what he was, as Alan Moore portrayed him.
Alan Moore definitely makes him out to be someone who gratuitously tortures the main character, and there's never really any good reason for it. He tortures her to the point where she is broken and, like, beaten, and you know, in the movie it's just kind of like, ooh, I have a stylish new short haircut.
And it's also like, ooh, well, I'm now, because of this torture experience, I'm a much stronger person. But there was far more to it in the actual book.
Yeah, no,
you know?
And she runs away in the comic book and stuff. Yeah, I really resented the fact that in the movie, like, the idea was that the worst thing he did to her was cut her hair. Oh no, my hair! I've been tortured! And it's like, well, also, didn't he, you know, do terrible other things, like beat you? Or I don't know.
I know. Okay, well, anyway, I want to actually get back onto the book.
Yeah, let's talk about
that. Yeah, I'm so sorry. Rambling digressions. Now, there's actually an interesting sort of image that you refer to frequently in the book, you know, of a woman gorging herself or the appetite of love, and how this sort of ties into money. You specifically refer to the man with two brains as your most prominent example, but you note, like, for example, that the brain makes Dolores' beautiful body so chubby that it is recognizable, and you tie this into financial status. But is this absolutely related to capitalism? I mean, you know, look at the first couple of lines of Twelfth Night. You know, if music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it. You know, I mean, is this, you know, the theme of food has been around a long time, and I'm not certain if that's an entire sort of, that's, how does like the notion of love and money tie into the capitalist monster? I found that to be an interesting sort of digression. Maybe because I love The Man with Two Brains and you're just totally trashing it, but, you know.
No, actually, I love The Man with Two Brains. I think that's a fantastic movie. Well, the thing that was interesting about The Man with Two Brains is that the main character, he's a kind of a Jekyll figure in a way, because he's a doctor, a professional doctor, quite wealthy. who is doing his own personal experiments. And he's married to a woman who's very beautiful and who only wants him for his money. And what he discovers in the course of doing all these experiments on brains is that he falls in love with the brain of this woman that he has in a jar. And there's all these great scenes of him.
Well, and of course, it's through music, interestingly enough. So that's a cultural sort of symbol.
Mm-hmm.
That if he falls in love with her because she was singing.
He meets her because she's singing. But then he falls in love with her because of their conversations. Yeah. And there's that great scene where he's taking her for a romantic boat ride, and he's out in the boat, and he has the brain in a jar. And so what's interesting in that film, what was interesting to me was that he trades the woman who wants him for his money for the brain, who really doesn't, you know, who only knows him as another brain. And but he does the classic thing that that men always seem to be doing in these brain movies, and I'm sure women will do it in brain movies too when we cast women in those roles. But he really wants to put the brain he loves in the body of the woman that he lusts after, who he's married to. So he puts the brain he loves into the body of his wife, who only wants him for his money, thus replacing the greedy woman, the woman who wants money, with the brain who just loves him. And then there's this horrible accident, and he's knocked out for months and in comatose. And at the end of the film, the part that you're talking about, his beautiful wife shows up, but she's completely fat now because the brain, it turns out, had an eating disorder. Yeah. And so even though it's this lovable brain, once it's embodied, you know, it turns into this fat woman. But there's actually this happy ending. It's a comedy, you know, so it has this happy ending where he's like, I don't care.
I don't know if it's necessarily about money. I think it's more about like the notion of like, oh, well, he's truly in love with her, whatever her physical form. I mean, that's how I interpret the
end. Yeah, no, you know? I think that's right. And I think that part of the thrust of that story and the reason why I talked about it was simply that he's able to sort of get out of the conundrum that Jekyll is often in, the Jekyll figure is often in, by reconciling his, you know, his desire for something carnal or his desire for something that is outside his professional standing with his, how do I put this? He's able to sort of reconcile his two selves. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the two selves in the Jekyll and Hyde narrative are usually two people who occupy very different class positions socially. Like, one is a very respected doctor and one is this kind of gnarly, knuckly, you know, low-class guy who goes around fucking girls for fun and wrecking havoc and killing and things like that. And so the side of him that does that is the side that does these nefarious experiments with brains. And at the end, when he unites the brain that he's experimented on with the body of this woman who really only was after him for his money, he kind of brings together those two halves. And so in that film, I see kind of a reconciliation going on that's sort of a nonviolent reconciliation. Unlike, for example, a movie like Pi, which is a really interesting film, although I don't actually normally like Darren Aronofsky. But he bugs me.
What about Requiem?
I really didn't like it.
Oh, man.
I know.
It's the most depressing movie. Yeah. But I
love depressing movies. It's not that. But I actually think Pi is really interesting because unlike Dr. Hafar in The Man with Two Brains, I love how they all have the goofy names, but he's not able to, he also reconciles his problem with his brain. But instead of doing it by sort of uniting his two selves, the part of him that's professional and the part of him that wants to kind of have this crazy, you know, anti-professional life, he's being pursued by people who want to use his ability to think highly sophisticated thoughts and to predict the stock market. So he's trying to escape from all these people who realize that his brain can be used to make money, right? And so instead of figuring out a way to reconcile the part of him that just wants to be a free individual to do, you know, able to do whatever experiments he wants, and the person who's going to be trapped into constantly thinking thoughts that will allow people to make money, he does he drills his brain out. He basically destroys his own brain instead of reconciling a good brain with a body that he likes. He's unable to reconcile anything. And so that's the sad version where somebody realizes that they're basically going to become a monster and has to destroy a part of themselves.
Well, we're looking at both, all of these options for these various characters that you have raised in forms of dichotomies that goes back to this Jekyll Hyde template of like two different classes.
Mm-hmm.
But is it really about two different classes? Is it not about being trapped within one particular class? Like, okay, so Jekyll, you know, he has this sort of middle class kind of, you know, lifestyle. But with that, the sort of upward mobility of not just being some sort of ditch digger, well, he has to subscribe to a certain kind of code of behavior that he pines for, but he can't actually do it, but Hyde can. So maybe Jekyll and Hyde is less a kind of examination of, like, the upper class versus the lower class. Maybe it's more of a kind of idea of, like, the impulse that all of us have. All of us have some sort of... you know, desire to do something completely outside of, you know, what we would normally do, or we set self-imposed kind of limits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that's the case, well, is this necessarily reflective of capitalism? Or, again, it goes back to this question I keep going back to. Is it individual impulse, or is it the system? It's chicken or the egg, you know?
Well, individuals always find their identities within a social system. You can never talk about an individual outside their social system. So I think... yes, it's about individuals struggling with the limitations placed on their identities by being in a particular kind of economic system in the United States. And so, absolutely, I think part of what Jekyll's struggle is, and what a lot of these, we're talking a lot about the mad doctors, a lot of them are struggling with the limitations imposed on them by being middle class. And some of those limitations are social, because there's a lot of social norms around what it means to be professional. Some of those limitations are mental limitations, because if you're forced to spend all day long thinking certain kinds of thoughts in order to make money, you essentially lose your mind for that period of time. Your ability to control your thoughts is lost, because if you don't think certain thoughts, if you don't write certain things or calculate certain figures, you're not going to make money because you'll be fired. So I would say... I mean, yes, the struggle, the Jekyll and Hyde struggle, is always the struggle to try to escape from those confines. But it's also about how that struggle ultimately is part of existing in a capitalist system where our identities are defined by class. And so part of the desire to step out of our identity is a desire to not necessarily escape from a class position, although that's part of it, but also to escape from an economic position of having to work for money. And, you know, when I say something like that, people often kind of raise their eyebrows like, but is there any other kind of work? Like, what do you mean? But the fact is that it's actually a fairly recent development that people would work for money specifically, and they would go onto the free market and sell themselves for cash. You know, in another mode of production like feudalism, you might own your own hotel, or you'd own your, not hotel, but an inn, or you'd own your own blacksmith business, and you would own your tools and you would produce things, and, you know, you might get things, you might trade for it, or you'd get money for the objects that you made, but you would be much more in control of the business environment. You would be owning the objects that you use to produce your horseshoes or to produce your swords or whatever you were making, your food you were making. And it wouldn't be like, I would pay you to come in and think thoughts about how to make better horseshoes all day long. And then you'd leave and you wouldn't get any horseshoes at the end of the day. And you wouldn't get any of the computers at the end of the day that you use to come up with your great horseshoe idea. I'm getting like really outlandish here in my ideas about what kind of labor people do now. But, you know, a lot of people do the equivalent of coming up with great horseshoes using computers. It's a very alienating experience, because instead of sort of being in a workshop that we own, that we control, where we can make things that are our things that we can then sell for prices that we think are reasonable, instead we become sort of thought machines where we come in and we conceptualize, but we don't really have any control over what we're conceptualizing. And I think that to bring this into a more concrete frame, I think that's that kind of experience is what shapes a movie like Pi, where we have a character who, he has this workshop where he's building interesting computer programs, and he wants to be free to think whatever thoughts he likes. But it turns out that some of his thoughts could be very valuable to various corporations and some other crazy people in the film, if you've seen it. And what he's struggling with is the fact that he fears that he's going to be turned into essentially a computer, an object, something that other people use in order to make money. And so he's not so much upset about the limitations of being middle class. He's upset about the limitations of labor when you have to do a certain kind of thinking all day long to make money for other people.
But he actually goes ahead and just makes the decision to get the mecha chip, which will allow him to actually come up with the magical number.
I'm so glad
number.
That you remember it's called the mecha chip. I love that.
Yeah. No, I love Aronofsky. And he makes the decision, knowing full well that the consequences are dealing with this crazed, you know, Marcy figure who is, you know, heckling him at every turn, knowing that, you know, that basically she's like the world's most, you know, annoying headhunter.
Right. She's this vicious capitalist, you know, she's a corporate drone who really wants to suck his brain out to make money. And, you know, he falls prey to the classic mad doctor problem, which is that he wants to solve the question, the intellectual question, can I predict the stock market? He's so excited about being able to do this that he, you know, allows himself to sort of fall in with a bad crowd. Or, you know, it's the same thing that happens in Donovan's brain where the main character, Patrick Corey, the mad doctor, you know, realizes that this brain he has is starting to exhibit, you know, terrifying powers, but he can't stop doing the experiment because he's so excited, like, wow, I keep a brain alive in a jar and it's growing bigger and throbbing and it's so neat, you know, I'm going to get to write a great scientific paper about it. So these are characters who are carried away by wanting to think thoughts that do go outside the bounds of the acceptable. But then at the same time, they're hemmed in by social expectation, or they're hemmed in by other kinds of people who represent the social forces of capitalism. The people who say, you know, now we're going to use this to make money instead of just use it for pure knowledge or for pure experimentation. I think that's part of the fear that we see in these stories, is not just the fear of class warfare, but the fear of just having to have a job where certain thoughts just get pruned away and you can't have that joyful, complete experiment unless you pay the price. And the price you pay is, okay, now we're going to make you sit here and think thoughts that you don't want to think in order to make money for us. And no free person wants to have to do that. Nobody wants to have to think someone else's thoughts all day.
Sure. We're running out of tape, but I want to ask you at least one final question, and that is Lovecraft, who I couldn't let this leave. But you make actually a very interesting and atypical observation of Lovecraft's work. You note that many of his critics accuse him of racism, and you note that he has this very unique sort of view of U.S. history, where it's about the hybridization from beginning to end. But I'm wondering if it's possible that, you know, Lovecraft's concern for a pre-Aryan world is, you know, without racial distinction, was actually a condemnation of racism, or actually a condemnation of sort of like the kind of assumptions that we place upon, like, you know, our existence. Maybe he was a skillful enough writer to sort of like pull this off and sell these stories and play off of the fears of like the white male readers who were sort of like, you know, tapping into the, you know, it's the exotic, because he had a very great appreciation of that.
That's a very Anna Lee type of move that you're trying to make. Now I will read the story exactly the opposite of the way it's supposed to be read, which is why we had that whole conversation earlier about Birth of a Nation. But I think Lovecraft is a perfect example of somebody who was 100% conflicted about how he felt about race. So he's written essays where he said point blank that he was a racist. He actually has an essay where he says, "I am a chalk white racist." At the same time, he married a Jewish woman, went to live in New York City in an area of town that was very polyglot. And was exposed to lots of immigrant culture, although he found that horrifying and wrote The Horror at Red Hook about how terrifying it was that all of these immigrants, who were actually monsters, of course, are sort of taking over the white culture of New York City. I think the thing that's super interesting about Lovecraft to me is that he exhibits perfectly the kind of ambivalence that a lot of white people had about racial minorities at that time in history, which is the 1920s and 30s, early 1930s.
The heyday, actually. There was a huge rise in the Ku Klux Klan during the 1920s.
Absolutely. Yeah, there was a huge rise. And also, going into the 30s, as the Depression deepened, a lot of tensions developed between working class whites and working class people of color as they competed for jobs, for example. And there was a lot of racist incidents with labor unions that would only allow whites in, which was a really tragic part of labor history in the U.S. So I think that Lovecraft's fascination with monsters that he associates with Caribbean peoples and with Native peoples is a reflection of a country that was drawn to non-European culture for its music and for those cultures' creativity, and which had essentially really intermingled with other kinds of cultures through bringing people to the States through slavery, but also through immigration as well. But at the same time, finding those other cultures terrifying and fearing that those cultures would utterly transform European culture into something unrecognizable and possibly monstrous. And I actually compare that kind of ambivalence, in the 20s to the ambivalence you see today. This is a bit off topic, but around issues of genetic engineering, where you get people talking about, will the human race be utterly transformed? What will happen to us? And I think at that time, there was the same fear, because it was a fear about miscegenation, a fear about what will happen if whites interbreed with these other people or intermingle with them. Will all of our particularity and all of what makes us, human be lost somehow? And I think that's what Lovecraft is playing with, is that fear and that wish to join with this interesting other culture, but the fear that it will transform us and that the next generation of people won't understand us at all. They'll be so different from us that they might as well be monsters.
Yeah, but there's all this scholarly work and all this concern for a classical sort of architecture. There's also decayed things throughout all of Lovecraft's work in terms of like this, there's a certain kind of, yes, you say that Lovecraft was 100% conflicted. I agree with you, but I think that it could be interpreted both ways, in the sense that, he's as much concerned with, the sort of both the maintenance or the restoration of previous sort of cultures, mm-hmm. as well as their inevitable sort of decay.
That's right. I think then that's what ambivalence is, right? Yeah. That he believes that there is an inevitability to any civilization decaying. And there's a part of him that really revels in that and loves describing it and thinks it's completely fascinating and looks forward to it in a certain way. And then there's another part of him that's completely repulsed and wants to travel back in time and see the dawn of civilization, back when Romans were Romans and we were all,
I'm thinking that the Lovecraft who wrote The Rats in the Walls was pretty damn concerned with, the inevitability of decay,
Yeah, no, and I'm not at all disagreeing with you, but I think that being concerned with the inevitability of decay and fascinated by it doesn't mean that he wasn't also at the same time horrified by it and disgusted by it, because it's not as if he portrays decay as being something enviable or desirable. At certain points he has characters who are very excited by joining with aliens, and hanging out with Cthulhu spawn under the sea. And that's something that those characters find very intoxicating. But as the narrator himself, Lovecraft portrays this as a kind of, fall from grace.
At this point, our young roving correspondent's tape ran out. That's really all that needs to be said. Tune in next time when our young roving correspondent talks with various mystery people from BoucherCon. And coming soon, a return appearance from a noted contemporary author. And church bells ringing, and people skipping merrily to work and dreaming.
you're stupid and you're lazy. Well, just keep earning.